The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Cast your mind back to the chat rooms and message boards of the ancient internet, places to connect communities of interest, from stamp collectors to much seedier types, to like-minded people from the world over. Then came the downsides, fears of kids getting lured in by strangers, and that millions flocking online to chat would kill face-to-face communication. As MySpace, Facebook, and Twitter declared the self to the world, those chat rooms receded until recently. Slack, GroupMe, WhatsApp, and a number of other apps are bringing chat back. Tech and culture writer Kyle Chayka wrote an article for Gizmodo defending chat, in fact, identifying chat circles as the only truly intimate online experience left. Kyle, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So while use of texting and social media did skyrocket, online chats receded. Why did they fall out of fashion?
I think as the internet grew, we actually got opportunities to connect with a much larger group of people. So as we found Facebook and big social media platforms, we were so excited to reach, you know, hundreds and thousands of people instead of just a few close friends. But I think lately we've been understanding that that's also a risky experience to be that exposed in the world.
So it sounds like you've had some experience with chat. What is it now for you?
So I think chat right now for me is really a way to connect to the people I'm closest with. And it's become kind of a small online space for just a few close friends. And specifically, I have a GroupMe chat with just a few friends that we all use it on our phones and our computers. And this is just a little chat room, and it looks kind of like a text window almost. Mm-hmm. But we all can interact with each other. We can post emoji. We can share photos. And it's just a lot of fun. It's a really nice way to share space with people online without having to be so exposed.
Yeah, I guess no one's watching, right?
Yeah, so it feels much more intimate, and I mean, personally, I feel much more able to, you know, share secrets or share feelings in that as opposed to Twitter, where it's obviously a much more public forum.
Well, I would welcome a place that's less snarky and, let's say, tacitly, sometimes overtly competitive, you know, than social media can be. But do you get to real conversations without being face-to-face?
I think you can. Chat online is obviously helped by having face-to-face experiences, but I think, and psychologists have found this as well, that within text-only chat spaces, you're actually more able to share things about yourself, and maybe that not having the burden of face-to-face interaction can help you be more intimate.
But you can also get it wrong, right? You know, that idea that you say something to someone and without a facial expression to follow it up, people can misinterpret.
They can definitely misinterpret, and text, I think, always has that danger. But I think if you grew up on the internet as I have and have enough experience and know the people you're talking to, it's pretty easy not to mess things up too badly. I think if you're trying to chat with strangers, you're not going to have as intimate or as close of an experience. But maybe that's what bigger social media platforms are for, is connecting with people you don't know. And then maybe someday you'll chat with them privately.
Well, you also mentioned, you mentioned GroupMe, also Slack you tried for the article, and WhatsApp. Something that I've used with people who live overseas, I guess it's texting without getting the text messaging charges. Any other advantage to WhatsApp?
Well, WhatsApp also has a variety of multimedia options that are a lot of fun. So you can share audio and you can, post various emoji. And it's kind of a richer experience than just text SMS messages.
Do you have to convince your friends to download these in order to use them, you know, to sort of expand your chat circle?
Yeah, I think you do. I mean, my GroupMe is very private, but there's a larger Slack that I'm in. And it's just sometimes you have to tell people what the advantages of those are or kind of show them what's going on before they actually want to be a part of it. Because everyone knows what text message is, but maybe group chat is a foreign experience now, even though it wasn't 10 years ago.
Mm. There's still the danger, of course, of whiling away many, many hours in these group chat rooms. And though you say it is safe and private and I guess wouldn't nix the job interview or offer, you know, because there's no photos of you doing jello shots in your underwear or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, someone in one of your circles could, for whatever reason, get mad, want to prove a point, post those conversations, couldn't they?
Yeah, definitely. And actually, that process of sharing something that was supposed to be private has been recently called doxing. So if a friend tries to dox you, then they're sharing some kind of secret that you posted online with the wider world. So that risk is always there. And I think in group chat, you still have to trust the people you're sharing with mm-hmm. enough.
Never mind what the people behind Slack or WhatsApp or GroupMe might do with your archive chats. Any ideas?
Yeah, so I think you have to assume that these companies still have access to everything you're saying. So there's always the possibility that the government or some other entity could track through what you've said and kind of expose that. So I don't think you want to always be aware of that, as you should be on any online platform.
Mm-hmm. Well, Facebook just launched Rooms earlier this fall. There are other big social media companies trying to get some kind of, you know, chat room experience like Snapchat. Do you think that people are seeking and finding refuge online, or is this just, you know, sort of another reaction to public social media that's probably going to snap back the other way?
I think to some extent it is a pendulum, but I think lately, especially with surveillance news and things like Gamergate, which have kind of proven the negative side of public interaction online, that we are going out of our way to seek out small spaces and creating them for ourselves through group chat. And through, I mean, even on Facebook, if you choose to open a room, that's a smaller space, but you're still within this wider platform. So you can kind of have both worlds at once, which I think is a good thing.
How about, Kyle, that worry from way back that we will, if we keep using these kind of media, lose our ability to communicate face to face?
Well, I hope the two coexist. I think personally, I find that I've kind of developed two different fluencies. One is talking through group chat and interacting on social media. And the other is, you know, still maintaining those face-to-face relationships and making sure the two complement each other. So I think we always have to keep going out of our way to seek people out and see them in person. You know, these group chats are not going to ever be a substitute for real life.
That's the tech and culture writer, Kyle Chayka. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can read Kyle's article, The Only Truly Intimate Online Experience Left, from Gizmodo. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You're only as old as you feel. Age is just a number. Don't worry, be happy. Sounds like empty fluff slapped on motivational posters. But what if it is more than that? What if the fountain of youth and the secret to healthy living is actually located in our minds? A psychologist set out to test the idea with a group of septuagenarians in New Hampshire. This was back in 1981. She called the experiment counterclockwise. And without the aid of a time machine, she managed to transport 8 70-year-old men 20 years into their past to see if they could reverse the aging process. Joining us to talk much more about the experiment and its implications is Bruce Grierson. He's a social science writer. He wrote the article, What If Age Is Nothing But a Mindset, for the New York Times Magazine. And Bruce, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thanks so much, Virginia, for having me.
So let's start with an explanation of the original counterclockwise experiment. And this was conducted by Harvard psychologist Ellen Langer.
Mm-hmm. Well, What Ellen did, now she was just beginning her career, very early stages of her career at Harvard. She's now the longest serving psychology prof in the department there, but this was a long time ago and she was just getting going. And it was a pretty radical, ambitious, provocative experiment to try back then. But she's always been interested in what she calls youth primes, things that put us in a position where we think about ourselves as younger, or we're kind of cued or prompted to think, or feelings of youthfulness are triggered. I guess that's the way to put it. And so she decided that what if we could put a bunch of older people in a setting where all the cues and all the environmental prompts suggested that it was in fact much earlier in their life than it really was. So they sort of tricked out an old converted monastery in New Hampshire to look like it was 1959. So everything about the decor and the books lying around and the shows on the black and white TV were from 1959. And the experimental subjects were encouraged to not just sort of think of this as a bit of a lark, but actually to try to buy into the illusion that they were in 1959, that they were 20 years younger than they were. And she coached them that if they were successful at this, they could actually see some really startling changes in their physiology, actually, and they would feel and measure as younger men.
So there were no mirrors there, no photographs allowed that showed them as their contemporary selves. What did she find? Did it actually work?
It did work to some degree. They were tested before and after on a whole battery of measures, as I say. Even things that you would never expect could possibly change under those, in a week of circumstances like that. Things like hearing and vision, and there were cognitive tests, and there were, you know, stretching and strength tests. And so they got the exact same battery of tests after the experiment was finished, a week, or I think it was
5 days,
5 days, mm-hmm. 5 days, yeah. They scored better on just about all those measures. And when there's a small sample size, you have to have a large effect for anybody to take it seriously. And this was a small sample. There were only 8 men. And so the effect had to be really pretty significant. And it was.
Yeah, and amazing results, but yet she never published these results. Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah, well, she was, as I say, she was early in her career, and I think she got a little bit scared. She just thought that they wouldn't, well, or she thought it wouldn't be published. She just didn't think that it would sort of penetrate the defenses of the judges in any major journal she sent it to, because as she keeps talking about, you know, mind-body stuff was just not very big back then. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is long enough in the past that this was all pretty woo-woo back then, and now we now know that, you know, mind-body effects and the placebo effect are real things and can be measured, and there's a fair bit of data, but back then it was pretty out there.
Well, in 1981, this sounded woo-woo, to use your term. But now, are there more of these kind of experiments being done?
I think that it's pretty well established that mind and body are pretty interconnected now. And we still don't really know the mechanisms. But one kind of hypothesis, I think that the way Ellen might frame it is that you have a kind of mental health on one side and physical health on the other. And then you have the immune system, which works as kind of an intermediary between the two. And there's lots of evidence now that, even when you think of it, things like stress management and managing loneliness and isolation, those are psychological interventions, but we know they have huge impact on our physical health. But in 81, we didn't really know. I mean, people were talking about it, but there hadn't been all that much science to establish it. And now, I mean, even looking at the science of mindfulness meditation or meditation and the effect on how that can lower blood pressure and lower heart rate, and these things are absolutely established now. So that's been a change in the last quarter century for sure.
What if age is nothing but a mindset? Well, Bruce Grierson is with us. He's a social science writer. He wrote an article in the New York Times with that very title, and he looked at a number of different placebo-based experiments on how the mind does actually physiologically control the aging process. The article was a huge hit, with hundreds and hundreds of comments from readers. Langer's current project takes this idea of the mind-body relationship and the healing power of the placebo further, shrinking tumors. Now, how is this experiment to work?
Well, Ellen decided that she really wanted to see how powerful this is, and she imagined the sort of one of the most dramatic possible outcomes you could have. And she had personal reasons for doing this too, which I talk about a little bit in the article. But she's currently undergoing an experiment where she has women with stage 4 breast cancer. They're stable. They're stable enough to travel, but this is a pretty dire diagnosis. And they are going to be brought to a villa in Mexico and given the same sort of counterclockwise intervention that those men in New Hampshire were back 30 years ago, in the sense that they're going to be brought back in time to a time before their diagnosis. And Ellen's hypothesis is that if they have similar kind of cues that will make them think of themselves as younger and sort of transport themselves back to a time before the diagnosis, they might be able to get a little bit better, mm-hmm. or shrink the tumors, I guess is the simplest way to say it. Can the effect of the mind alone have an impact on something as serious and intractable as cancer?
I'm also thinking about placebos in general. I mean, there is a thought that they're manipulative on some level, or unfair. You know, somebody gets the good cancer drug, somebody else gets the sugar pill. Even cruel on some level. What is Langer's approach? How much does she let people know what's going on?
If you know what's going on, if you're told that the pill that you're going to take is in fact a sugar pill, or in this case of the cancer study, these women obviously know that that the intervention here is supposed to help them. And so what that's called is an open placebo, as opposed to the deceptive closed placebo that most of us are familiar with. And an open placebo is, yeah, if you know the thing that the pill that you're taking is a sugar pill, how can it possibly work? Doesn't that defeat the whole idea of placebo? And there's some evidence that even if you know that it's fake, that it still can work. There were some studies done with ADHD kids who were able to wean themselves off their medication, and there was a study done with irritable bowel syndrome, an open placebo study that showed that it can work. So it seems wildly counterintuitive that an open placebo study could work, but that's what effectively this cancer study is. They know that what's supposed to happen. They know that it's merely psychological, and Ellen's hope is that that doesn't matter. It'll still work.
Is there a concern, Bruce, that by claiming that the mind can heal the body, that patients who do succumb to illness or aging will just feel, you know, dejected, weaker if they can't will themselves to get better?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the whole blaming the victim
right thing.
And that, if you look at the comments on the following that article, there were a fair number of people who latched onto that very point. And we addressed it in the piece, and I asked Ellen about it too. And she has been actually talked to by people after her presentations and things. One guy in particular, whose wife died of cancer, and she fought it, and she still couldn't overcome it just mentally. And he felt like they'd been presented as failures because they weren't able to defeat this thing. And this guy felt that Ellen was effectively blaming the victim if they can't manage to do it. And Ellen would say that, I mean, it's a tough one. I don't think it's incumbent upon everyone to be able to beat every disease that they face. I think realistically, is this going to work for everybody? Is this going to shrink tumors? I think it's unlikely. Mm-hmm. But I also think that Ellen has done enough sound work to be taken seriously and given a chance to see whether it can.
Well, Bruce, thank you very much for running through the story with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Bruce Grierson, social science writer and the author of What Makes Olga Run? The subtitle of the book says it all. The mystery of the 90-something track star and what she can teach us about living longer, happier lives. We found his recent article, What If Age Is Nothing But a Mindset? In the New York Times Magazine. You'll find a link to read the article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire has one of the oldest populations in the country, second only to Maine, where the median age is 43 and a half. And as Maine's population continues to age, so do its drivers. Leslie Chang brings us this story about keeping older senior drivers safe and what they have to say about staying behind the wheel.
It's a Saturday morning in Damariscotta, Maine. 8 students are sitting at wooden desks, ready for their driver safety class to begin.
It is after 10, so let's get started.
But these students aren't teenagers going through driver's ed for the first time. Not by a long shot. Here's Joyce, the class instructor.
Pre-course quiz, page 5. We'll pick on you, Gene. What's the most common traffic violation committed by older drivers? Following too closely, failure to yield the right of way, not stopping for stop signs or traffic lights, making an improper left turn.
God.
Well, pick one.
The correct answer, failure to yield. This class is run by the AARP, and the elderly drivers are here to refresh themselves on driver safety. The first wave of baby boomers turned 67 this year, meaning that across the United States, there are more and more seniors on the road. In Maine, a full 20% of drivers are senior citizens, and that percentage is growing. Driving gets more difficult as people age. Vision isn't as sharp, especially at night, and reaction times aren't as quick. Physical ailments like arthritis can affect driving, and so can hearing loss. But even with these difficulties, many seniors continue to drive. A lot of elderly Mainers live in rural areas and rely heavily on their cars. Even if they did want to give up driving, there aren't a lot of transportation alternatives. Most areas in Maine don't have good public transit. But at a certain point, seniors simply should not be on the road anymore. According to AAA, the American Automobile Association, people tend to outlive their ability to drive safely by 7 to 10 years. The seniors here at the driver safety class recognize that they won't be on the road forever. Here's Ed McDonald.
I don't know when I'm going to stop driving, but I'll know when. There's no question about that in my mind. I'll know when I have to stop.
Listen, if I thought I was a danger to anyone, including myself, I would not drive.
That's Phyllis Bishop. But if seniors don't give up the keys themselves, the state will step in. The Bureau of Motor Vehicles in Maine, or the BMV, requires drivers to renew their license every 4 years once they reach the age of 65. This involves a vision test and sometimes a written test as well. Ed Hodges had gotten into a small accident, and according to him, it was just a bump. But because of the accident, the BMV asked him to take a written test to renew his license.
Not the driving part, the book part. And that book they want you to read is like half an inch thick, and it has all these idiotic questions in it and all these road signs that I've never seen anywhere that you have to memorize all of that stuff. And getting old and cranky, and I never made the grade.
Luckily for Ed, his wife still drives, and she can take him where he needs to go. But he says it's not the same.
On the whole, I'd rather be driving myself. Nothing I can do about that.
The BMV will take seniors off the road, but the responsibility often falls on family, and feelings can get hurt. Meet Nancy McCusick. Like Ed Hodges, she no longer drives. Nancy wants to renew her license, but her children don't think it's a good idea.
I had an exam scheduled for September 13th, and the kids don't want me to drive, so they blocked it. And then I had another exam scheduled for yesterday, as a matter of fact, and they blocked that. The kids don't want me to drive. They don't even want me to take an exam.
Losing a driver's license can be an extremely frustrating transition. Rayette Hudon is a senior driving specialist at AAA. She says that the best way to ease that transition is preparation. Seniors should plan ahead for their driving retirement and figure out how they're going to get around even before they give up their licenses. For Ayette, focusing on senior driving isn't just her job. It's also an issue she's facing personally with her elderly mother, who lives in Wells. Like many towns in Maine, Wells is impossible to get around without a car.
Somebody has to take her to the hairdresser, someone has to take her to the grocery store, someone has to, because there's no public transportation for her.
Rayette's siblings all live nearby, so it's easy for her mother to find rides. But not every family is in a position to take on the responsibility. So a few nonprofits in Maine are offering a solution.
Down on the right, it'll be, it's 219.
This is Dee Dee Stokely. She gives rides to seniors through an organization called ITN Portland. Seniors pay about $9 a ride, but it's designed to feel like a friend is picking you up, so no money is exchanged in the car. Dee Dee gets reimbursed later for her gas, but her time is all volunteered. She's a senior herself, like many of the other volunteers at ITN. Dee Dee drives a silver Prius, and she's pulling up to a yellow house
in
South Portland. Dee Dee is taking Alice Crabb to a grocery store this morning. Alice lives alone, and she's been using ITN for over 11 years.
I take it at least once a week for a standard appointment that I go to. And then I use it for grocery shopping and for doctor's appointments.
ITN works for seniors in the Portland area who can afford to pay for the service. Other nonprofits and community groups are also finding ways to get seniors where they need to go. Groups like Island Connections on Mount Desert Island and local churches across the state. But there are still a lot of seniors driving themselves in Maine. And for them, there are other steps that can be taken to make sure they stay safe. This conversation is starting to happen not just in Maine, but on a national level. TRIP, a nonprofit group based in Washington, D.C., published a report on ways that infrastructure changes could help people cope in later years. This includes improving public transit and installing bigger traffic signs, better street lighting, and more rumble strips. Other resources are out there, too. A few years ago, AAA released a free online screening service called the Roadwise Review. Rayette explains that it tests a variety of age-related issues.
Visual acuity, hip and leg movement, different types of mobility. That will give you a readout of what you might want to be doing in order to drive safer.
Resources like the Roadwise Review and the AARP Driver Safety Class can help people continue to drive safely in later years. Seniors enjoy driving just like everyone else. Making the decision to give that up will always be difficult. Phyllis, who we met back at the driver safety class, says there's really no replacement for being behind the wheel.
I love to drive. It's one of my favorite things to do, besides bowling. I bowl also. But it gives me my independence that I can get in my own car and not have to depend on someone else to take me here and take me there. I think that would just about kill me, you know, because I love to drive.
And our thanks to Leslie Chang for that story. One reason people tell us they listen to public radio is to hear different perspectives and diverse voices. It's that sort of reporting that reveals the complex individual nature of issues and their effects on real human lives. So please call now to support reporting that goes beyond the loudest or the most strident opinion. It'll take just 2 minutes and pay off for a long time to come.